staying on top of the changes reshaping how we work and live feels more important than ever, especially right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. These shifts really touch everything in our community.
Absolutely. And today, we're diving into the rise of the gig economy to understand its potential impact right here in Southeast Houston. It's really about grasping this significant shift in work.
Yeah, and seeing the opportunities, but also maybe the challenges it brings for, you know, folks around here and local businesses.
Exactly. And to help us unpack it, we're looking at a discussion with Arun Sundarajan from NYU Stern and Steve King from Emergent Research. They were speaking at the Dole Institute of Politics.
Right. And they had some really insightful takes on what this gig economy even is, how big it might be, how it's growing, and importantly, the regulations around it.
And these guys know their stuff. Arun, he literally wrote the book on the sharing economy. And Steve's firm, Emergent Research, they've been surveying independent workers for like a decade. So real depth of knowledge there.
Okay, so our goal today is to pull out the key insights for you, our listeners. We want to get clear on what the gig economy means, its scale, how it's evolving, and, you know, what it could mean locally.
Good plan. And maybe the first thing to tackle is that term itself, gig economy. It seems like everyone uses it, but maybe not everyone means the same thing.
That's what Aaron pointed out, right? Sometimes it's just a new label for stuff we already know, like freelancing or contract work.
Exactly. But he also said it increasingly points to this newer kind of independent work that's enabled by online platforms. Think Uber, Airbnb, DoorDash, things we see and use every day, even here.
But he prefers a different term, doesn't he? Something broader.
Yeah, he uses non-employment work. He feels it's more neutral and covers everything outside that traditional W-2 job. He made the point that for a lot of the 20th century, that standard job was the norm. Now we're seeing way more variety.
And how does the sharing economy fit into that? Because he wrote about that specifically.
Right. He actually felt crowd-based capitalism was a better fit for what he was describing there. It's more about people using their own assets like a car or a spare room to earn money, often through these digital marketplaces.
So renting out your driveway on some app, that counts too.
Under his broader umbrella of non-employment work, yeah. It's just another way people are generating income outside a typical job. The sharing economy is kind of a subset of this bigger shift.
Okay. And Steve King, he agreed it's broad, but he also highlighted the confusion caused by all these different definitions flying around.
Totally. It's a real challenge. He mentioned that even big players like the Bureau of Labor Statistics or McKinsey, they don't have one single agreed upon definition. Economy gets used as this catch-all sometimes.
Which makes comparing research kind of tough, I imagine.
Definitely. So Steve and Emergent Research, they try to be a bit more specific. They tend to use gig economy for those shorter term, often platform-based things, like maybe driving for Lyft.
And for the rest.
They'll use terms like independent workers or stick with non-employed labor for that whole big category. It just helps clarify things a bit.
And that makes sense locally, right? I mean, think about the handyman down the street or the CPA who works for themselves here in Pasadena or LaPorte. Yeah. They're not necessarily on an app.
Precisely. Those folks are definitely part of this non-employment world, but maybe not what everyone pictures when they hear gig economy. The platforms are just one part of it.
Okay. Definition clarified. Somewhat. Let's talk size. How many people are we actually talking about in this non-employment space? The numbers seem all over the place.
They really are. You see estimates from, say, 30, 35 million Americans on the low end, all the way up to over 80 million.
Wow, 80 million compared to the total workforce, which is what, about 145 million?
Yeah, around that. So even the low estimates show it's a pretty big chunk of the economy.
So why the huge range? 30 million versus 80 million is a lot.
A big reason, Steve pointed out, is simply how you define work. Some of those higher numbers might include really casual things like occasional babysitting, selling something on Craigslist, maybe even taking online surveys for a few bucks.
Ah, okay. So more inclusive definitions give bigger numbers. What does Emergent Research usually find?
Their estimate focuses on people earning income from non-employment work at least once a month. That brings the number down to around 40 million. Still very significant.
40 million. That's still a huge number of people.
Absolutely. And maybe more important than the exact number is the trend. This sector, however you define it precisely, has been growing faster than the overall labor force.
Faster. How much faster?
Well, Emergent Research pegs traditional labor force growth at maybe under 1% per year. But non-employment work, that's been growing closer to 2% annually over the last decade or so.
So it's outpacing traditional job growth. That definitely has implications for us here in Southeast Houston.
For sure. It suggests a growing part of our local economic activity is happening outside standard jobs.
And is this mostly side hustles, or are people doing this full-time?
The data suggests most people are doing it part-time, you know, supplementing income from a regular job, maybe pursuing a passion project that brings in some cash.
Okay.
The number relying on it as their main source of income is smaller, maybe around 15 to 20 million, which actually lines up pretty well with the Bureau of Labor Statistics figures for self-employed individuals.
But Arun Sundarrajan had a pretty bold prediction about the future, didn't he?
He really did. He thinks that within the next couple of decades, the majority of the workforce will primarily earn their living through non-employment arrangements.
Wow. The majority. What makes him think that?
He argues the pandemic was a major accelerant. It forced companies to really embrace remote work and rethink how work gets done. Both those trends, he believes, lean towards using non-employee labor more often. He sees that growth speeding up.
That's a massive shift to think about for our local job market here. More flexibility, maybe, but big questions about stability, benefits.
Huge questions. Which brings us nicely to the role of the platforms themselves, the Ubers, the Fivers, the DoorDashes. How much of the non-employment picture do they really represent?
Yeah, are they the whole story or just the most visible part?
Definitely more the visible part. Steve reminded us there are hundreds of these online talent marketplaces out there. He mentioned something like 350 for knowledge work, over 400 for non-knowledge work, just in the U.S.
So way beyond ride-sharing and food delivery. We're talking graphic designers on Upwork, writers on Fiverr.
Exactly. Yeah. All sorts of skills and services. And Emergence data shows about 27% of full-time independents use a platform sometimes, often just to supplement other freelance work. For part-timers, it's maybe a third using them at least occasionally.
Okay, so platforms are a tool, but not the only way these folks find work.
Pretty much. Now, the big names are still huge individually. Uber, before the pandemic, had maybe 800,000 drivers in the U.S., more recently around 500K. Lyft, maybe 300K.
Those are big numbers on their own.
They are, but compared to the 145 million total workforce, each platform is relatively small. It's the aggregate effect of all these platforms together that's really significant and growing.
And these platforms, they've definitely shaken things up for older industries, haven't they? Like the taxi example they discussed?
Oh, yeah. That St. Louis taxi story really highlights the disruption. Taxis had all these costs, medallions, insurance, employee costs. Then ride-sharing comes in with much lower barriers to entry for drivers. Big change.
And the first reaction from cities and established players was often pushback, right? Lobbying, trying to block them?
Absolutely. Lots of resistance initially. But Arun argued that now cities are kind of cautiously embracing them more. They see these platforms are dominant and aren't going away.
So less fighting, more integrating.
Sort of. You see examples like Airbnb starting to collect local taxes, trying to work within local rules. They're shifting from being just antagonists to maybe partners in some ways.
Is that proactive, though? Are cities planning for the next platform or just reacting when one gets big?
It seems to be moving towards more proactive thinking. Initially, yeah, it was reactive. But now you see places like New York State actually changing tax laws to deal with Airbnb rentals. That suggests they're trying to build framework that can handle these new models.
Okay.
Arun also noted it's happening faster in places like China or South Korea with younger middle classes. But the trend is definitely here in the U.S. and Europe, too.
Which leads right into the regulatory minefield, classifying the workers. Employee or independent contractor? That seems like the million-dollar question.
It really is. As Dee pointed out, our current labor laws just weren't built for this kind of work.
Yeah.
You've got this tension. Many workers genuinely value the flexibility of being independent.
Sure, setting their own hours.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But then a significant number, maybe especially those doing it full-time or in lower-paying sectors, really want and need the protections and benefits that come with being an employee.
Like minimum wage, overtime, unemployment insurance.
Right. So the challenge is, how do you protect vulnerable workers without killing the flexibility that others rely on? California's AB 5 law tried to push more workers towards employee status.
And then Proposition 22 pushed back specifically for app-based drivers, creating a kind of middle ground.
Exactly. Prop 22 is an example of this third-way idea.
Yep.
It keeps drivers as independent contractors, but mandates certain benefits and earning standards. The UK has a similar worker status for Uber drivers now.
How do the experts view this third way?
Steve mentioned he was initially skeptical, but he's coming around to seeing it as a potential compromise, a way to thread that needle.
And Arun?
Arun seemed quite positive about the Prop 22 structure. He likes that it separates benefits from the strict employee contractor classification. His big point is that we need new ways to fund benefits and safety nets for non-employees in the future,
rather than trying to shoehorn everyone back into the old model.
Precisely. He thinks trying to force everyone into traditional employment misses the point and ignores the diverse needs of these workers. Some might prioritize income stability, others paid time off, or retirement funds, or healthcare access. It's not one size fits all.
It also shifts who holds the risk, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Less reliance on big companies means more financial risk lands on the individual. Think about Hertz filing for bankruptcy during the pandemic versus Uber weathering the storm relatively better because its drivers aren't direct employees bearing those fleet costs.
So governments need new ways to manage that societal risk beyond just traditional unemployment checks.
That's Arun's argument. We need to rethink the social safety net. Is there a perfect answer yet? Probably not. But things like Prop 22 are maybe early experiments in figuring that out.
Let's talk about COVID-19 more directly. Arun did some specific research on Uber Eats and restaurants, right?
Yes, and it was fascinating. It really drove home how crucial these platforms became, especially for local businesses when lockdowns hit. Think about our own local spots here in Deer Park or La Porte. How did they reach customers when dining rooms were closed?
Delivery apps became essential overnight for many.
Exactly. And Arun's research found that restaurants using these platforms had significantly higher survival rates. They actually saw increased order volumes, even if their hours were cut. It showed this kind of digital resilience.
So platforms aren't just about gigs or Amazon deliveries. They're becoming part of the local infrastructure.
That's the key takeaway. They're vital for local commerce. And it raises an interesting hypothesis. Did cities that were more open to platforms like Airbnb or DoorDash maybe fare a bit better economically during the pandemic?
Is there evidence for that?
Arun mentioned some early signs. Cities with looser Airbnb rules seem to see tourism bounce back a bit quicker. And platform-based transport, like BlaBlaCar in France, apparently recovered faster than traditional trains. More research is needed, but it's suggestive.
So what's the lesson for city planners, maybe even here locally?
Arun's point is that cities need to think beyond just roads and bridges now. They need a platform policy. How do they integrate these tools for transport, for accommodation, for supporting local shops and restaurants?
Maybe even partnering with them?
Yeah, he suggested things like exploring revenue sharing or using ride sharing to supplement public transit, like some cities are doing for paratransit services. It's about proactive engagement, not just reaction.
And what did Steve observe about attitudes towards independent work during the pandemic? Did people flock to it or shy away?
It was interesting. He said there was an initial dip right at the start, understandably. But then starting later in 2020, there was a huge surge. Lots of new people becoming freelancers or gig workers.
Really? Why do you think that was?
Well, maybe uncertainty in traditional jobs, layoffs, but also maybe seeing new opportunities. He mentioned applications for new sole proprietor tax IDs, EIN numbers more than doubled. Interest in platforms like Fiverr and Upwork shot up.
And the government support probably played a role too.
Definitely. The fact that pandemic unemployment assistance was available to non-employees for the first time was a massive deal. It provided a safety net that just wasn't there before.
But it's not all smooth sailing, right? You mentioned churn earlier.
Right. Steve noted high turnover, especially in lower skilled platform work. People try it, maybe the income isn't what they expected, or the work is harder than it looks, and they move on.
And does more competition drive down earnings?
That's an ongoing debate. More workers potentially means more competition, which could put downward pressure on rates in some areas. It's complex.
One last thing on the pandemic effect. Are people actually choosing where to live based on how friendly a place is to this kind of work?
It's maybe early days for that being a major driver, but there are hints. Steve mentioned places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, or parts of New Hampshire actively recruiting remote workers with incentives. Many of those remote workers are likely freelancers or independent contractors.
And we've seen cities like Chattanooga attract tech workers partly by building that whole tech-friendly ecosystem.
Exactly. So, a city's stance on remote work, platform regulation, broadband access, could increasingly become a factor in attracting talent, especially knowledge workers who have more location flexibility.
Okay, so let's try to wrap our arms around this. It's clear the gig economy, or maybe better, non-employment work, is a really significant and growing part of the economy. Definitions are still kind of fuzzy, regulations are playing catch-up.
Right. And platforms are a major factor, especially for local businesses and resilience, like we saw during COVID. The future seems tilted towards more people working this way, which forces us to think hard about new models for benefits and worker protections.
In bringing it back home, for us here at Think and Act Locally, serving Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, these aren't just abstract trends. They could really change things right here in Southeast Houston.
For sure. Our local businesses might need to adapt, maybe use platforms more. Our neighbors might find new ways to earn income, but they'll need to navigate the challenges of stability and benefits. And our local government will have decisions to make about how to regulate and maybe even leverage these changes.
So maybe the final thought for our listeners right here in our community, as work keeps changing so fast, what role can we as individual residents, as local policymakers play in shaping a future that works well for everyone in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena?
Yeah. What proactive steps could we take locally? How do we encourage the good parts, the innovation, while making sure people are secure and our community stays strong?
It really gets to the heart of what we try to do here with Think and Act Locally, giving you information to understand these big shifts and think about your role in our local picture.
Exactly. Empowering local action through understanding.
And if you found this deep dive valuable today, if it gave you something to think about regarding our community, please do consider supporting our work. You can find out how at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. That link is also in the show notes.